Welcome to the Iron Butterfly Podcast. My name is Megan Jaffer.
And I'm Katie Hopkins, and we will be your hosts.
We created Iron Butterfly Podcast in honor of Eloise Page, the original Iron Butterfly. 80 years ago, Eloise joined the Office of Strategic Services, trailblazing a path for what ultimately became the United States intelligence community. She rose the ranks from secretary to case officer, defying the norms of her time, and eventually became the first female chief of station at CIA. Eloise was known among her colleagues to be a fierce fighter with a core of steel, and she earned the codename Iron Butterfly. Our podcast continues her legacy, inviting the unsung heroines of the United States intelligence community to share their stories with aspiring leaders like you. Women in the intelligence community are special because they have dedicated their lives to studying the whole world. And through conversations with hundreds of women in intelligence over the past few years, we have come to understand that the world is at an inflection point. Women hold a more central role in society than ever before. And at Iron Butterfly Media, we are committed to amplifying authentic voices that inspire women to create wherever they are. So pull up a chair. Our changing world needs new ideas made real, which begins with you. Welcome to Iron Butterfly Podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Amanda Young, and I am producer of the Iron Butterfly Podcast. And I'm going to be introducing our guests today. Before we do that, though, here is a little bit about me. I joined Iron Butterfly in October of 2021 and have since had the great fortune of working with Katie and Megan, scheming, planning, dreaming, and manifesting our way through the last several years and well into the future. But prior to joining Iron Butterfly, I moved to the area and looking to pursue a role in the intelligence community. I'm originally from Northern California and studied at the California State University in Monterey Bay and the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. And so felt the call to service and moved to the area in January of 2020. But as life would have it, COVID hit shortly after I had moved here and quickly had to pivot and kind of change direction in how I intended to kind of serve my country and how I was going to get involved with whether it was the intelligence community or the private sector. So in 2020, I was fortunate enough to have joined AWIC, or the Amazing Women of the Intelligence Community. And that is how I was introduced to Megan and then Katie there shortly thereafter. But later that year, I then joined Iron Butterfly and the team and have worked as a producer ever since. But also in tandem when that happened, I joined a space company, a company that was a startup in the space community, and spent some time there and then quickly transitioned into another role with a company called Altana Technologies, which is where I still currently work today, and work there as a technical account manager and serve customers within the IC and within the federal government in empowering them to build safer and more resilient supply chains with our technology. So moving to Christy, today we are joined by Christy Scott, who is an associate general counsel at the CIA and has worked in several roles across the national security community, focusing on privacy and civil liberties law. Christy describes herself as funny, competitive, and compassionate. She's a huge Steelers and Housewives fan, more to come on that. And most importantly, she loves being a mom. Christy, we're so excited to have you on the podcast. Welcome to Iron Butterfly.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh my gosh.
We're excited.
We are very excited.
Should we tell the story of how we met?
So I was wondering if we could. Is it?
Yes.
Do you think we should?
100%. It's part of the story.
I mean the full story.
The full story.
You want to start it?
No, you start it.
We always have a problem with who's going to start the stories first. Even when we're like talking about Iron Butterfly, we're like, who's going to start?
We're just so inclusive.
Okay. Love it. So a couple days before we had reached out to you because Katie had this really brilliant idea. And she has lots of brilliant ideas. That's why I love her. And she said, you know, there are so many people that we don't know that follow us and that like our posts and that comment on our posts. And I think we should start reaching out to some of these people and just saying thank you and that, like, we notice you. And so you were on that list.
Yay.
And we had reached out and said, we'd love to just, you know, jump on a call with you. I don't even know if you knew why we were jumping on a call with you at that point. And so we had this call scheduled. And then the day before, we were talking about, did we talk about it first? We were talking about just the perception of, like, and the intelligence community, you know, writ large, but specifically about NSA and how people think, or they say things like, you know, NSA is spying on you, and they read all your emails and they track all your phone calls and text messages and emails. And, you know, we all know, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, that that's just,
true.
It's not true for many reasons.
Yeah.
And we're going to smash that myth a little bit later. But Katie and I were talking about this and how it just infuriates us because it's really, you know, it's just not true. So fast forward, like a couple days later, I was listening. So one of my favorite comedians, I listen to a lot of comedians' podcasts, and
this is why I wanted you to tell the story.
And we bonded immediately because we both have that love of comedy.
Yes.
And it just makes, you know, the same comedians, but just that love of comedy just makes us happy.
Yes, totally. Because it, you know, especially during COVID, you know, I wanted to watch and hear things that made me smile and uplifted me. Not
right.
There was a lot of negativity that was happening at that time. And I just wanted at the end of the night to smile and to laugh before I went to bed. So I would listen to comedians.
That's right.
And so one of the podcasts I listened to is Bad Friends with Bobby Lee and Andrew Santino. And they talk a lot about, you know, many people know that Joe Rogan has a lot of comedians on, and they usually wait until they're promoting something so because he has a large audience. So Bobby Lee had said a bunch of times, I'm waiting until I pitch something big, then I'm going to ask Joe to get on his podcast.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I saw in my stream that he was on. So I'm like, oh, he's been waiting for a long time. I can't wait to listen to this. It's going to be great. So I listen.
Wow.
And in the beginning, it was great. They were talking about how long they knew each other, all the stories, like crazy stories, raunchy stories that they have. And then I think it was like, I don't know exactly, but I knew the timestamp when I referenced it. It was like 52 minutes and 14 seconds. All of a sudden, they start talking about how Joe Rogan was saying how NSA tracks your emails and your phone calls. And I paused at that moment because I'm like, oh my goodness, we were just talking about this. So I send it to Katie and I'm like, this is what's wrong. He has such a big audience. And, you know,
such a tremendous reach.
Right. Totally. He does. Yeah. And he's being, I'm sure people have been telling him that. And so that's what he thinks it is. I can't blame him, you know, really, because it's what he's hearing. So then fast forward a day, I'm already worked up because
we were like, what are we going to do about this?
What are we going to do about this? We were thinking about all the people we could, you know, have on his podcast to combat that narrative, right? The very next day, we get on a call with you.
It's the butterfly effect.
And the call was just about to say thank you and how nice it is that we have supporters like you. And we ended up talking about, you know, we just got to know you. And then we realized we wanted you on the podcast. And then it clicked.
Wow.
Because of what your...
That's right.
What your background is. And we were just like, oh my goodness.
So clearly the universe wants you here, really, is what we're trying to say.
Well, I am such a fan of this show. I think, and going back to the space of having women and strong women in this community, and then also really to kind of talk about these issues so that the public has some understanding of what's really going on, what's not going on, and having a space for those conversations. Because I think, you know, one of the things that Justice O'Connor was so passionate about was having civics in school and that ability to talk about these issues, because it's so vital for our democracy. And when people start to think and believe those things, it's just unhealthy. And so I was thrilled to talk to both of you, and I just feel so honored and special, because I'm such a fan of the show. And I think what you guys are doing is going to inspire that next generation of young women. I know that's key to your hearts, to keeping the show on. And so I just feel special just to even be here.
Well, welcome. Thank you. You definitely deserve to be here. And we can't wait. We are going to dive into what we just talked about in a little bit. Okay. But before we do that, we want to get to know you a little bit. We want our audience to get mm-hmm. to know you. So just for our audience sake, we've only talked to you once. And so we don't even know your whole story. And so we'd like to just know about you. Where did you grow up, and where are you from, and where, you know, when did you come here, you know, to DC, and when did you decide that this space was where you wanted to be?
Wow, thank you for that question. I like to think of myself, and one of the reasons why I was drawn to Iron Butterfly and all things that you all have put forward is just the name Iron. So I'm from outside of Pittsburgh, so about 30 minutes south of Pittsburgh. So I am what I consider to be kind of a blue collar person. But in terms of me, I am the first person in my family to graduate from college. Certainly the first person to go to law school, and grew up in the housing projects. And really just, I think, in a situation that is non-traditional, and really one that isn't a natural fit from my background to the intelligence community, where you both know some days you're the only woman in the room. And I think, you know, I'm a double minority in that sense of being an African-American woman, but also a woman that came from, you know, a very, just to be frank, poor background. But one of the things I think, you know, that is I like to think part of my story. You know, I lost my mother when I was 13 to tragic circumstances, but it really forced me to grow up fast and to have an appreciation for the power of education, because I strongly believe that education is really just the equalizer in society, because I think that much like the, you know, NSA is listening to everything, which is not. But when people don't have the critical thinking skills to combat that, to say, okay, well, are they, or why is that not feasible, or why is that not possible, that it really just erodes kind of our democracy. So I am very fortunate in that I had some amazing teachers and people who believed in me that said, you know what, you can't go to college. And I was fortunate to get a scholarship to undergrad, a scholarship to law school, and then just have people believe and foster in that. And my belief, and one of the stories that I tell, I went back and spoke at my high school graduation probably about 10 years ago. And I remember, you know, telling the story of, you know, I told my guidance counselor, I'm like 16, 17, I'd like to be a lawyer. And he laughed me out of the room and said, no, Chrissy, have you thought about going to school to be a manicurist? Or,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. And, you know, the nail industry is something that you should consider. And I'm like, that's not what I want to do. And so I just remember using kind of that sort of naysayer perspective to say, you know what, I am going to be a lawyer. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to serve my country. And, you know, using those things that I felt might have been negative or might have deterred me to really fuel that. And so I was raised by my grandmother, who had an eighth grade education. And although she wasn't formally educated, because she took time to raise her sister who had Downs at the time, which, you know, now thankfully we're a more involved society. But they told her to institutionalize her sister, so she really didn't have those opportunities. But she fostered in my sister and I just the love of books and reading and really just to kind of get out of that, you know, those kind of four small walls that we were in, but to really think of things and the world as a much bigger place.
That's amazing. Is there something that you remember reading with your grandmother?
Oh, man. Oh, that's a good question.
We'd read so many things together. And, you know, she was also a very good storyteller. But I think the things that we would read together, one, I think the Bible, because it fueled her faith. And I think that was imparted in me as well. And I thought that the Bible was such, you know, sort of irrespective of religion, it's just a wonderful book that has so many wonderful stories. So we would read the Bible together, but I think the authors that profoundly affected me were obviously Harper Lee. To Kill a Mockingbird was something that inspired me to go to law school. And I saw that Atticus Finch was such a change agent, and there were so many different layers to that story. And so those were two books that really motivated me.
I'm also curious, Christy, if there is, so you mentioned your guidance counselor who clearly was
off his rocker or her rocker.
I'm not going to name him. I'll protect his source and the method.
I was going to put it more gently, but that's way better. That's way better and more accurate. Were there any people who stood out or who stand out in your memory who were really champions of yours, or like who were the teachers or mentors who helped you see that was a future that you could have?
Well, and I want to add to that, because I was thinking, like, when he said that, you clearly were like, no, right?
Yeah.
But was it other people, or was it something in yourself where you were like,
good question.
You know, is this guy... You know,
off his rocker.
Yeah, he's off his rocker. I'm not gonna. No, look, I have friends who are nail technicians. They're
right?
great.
They are.
But that you were like, no, I want to be a lawyer, and I don't want someone else. You know, did that come from what
totally.
Katie is saying, external source, or was that within you?
I think it was a combination of both. I think there was something that it didn't sit right in my spirit, where I'm like, wait a minute, I think. You know, if they would take a moment to see beyond kind of the external, you know, stuff that was going on, they would see that there's more. But I really was fortunate, and I'll give her a shout out. Her name was Mrs. Trucca and Miss Wade. And, you know, having lost my mother at 13 and at such a young age, I was also going through that teen angst and just a lot of emotions at the time. But I remember they would, you know, pull me to the side. And one of the things that the teacher, Ms. Trucca, did was she applied for scholarships on my behalf, and I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And at the time, now sort of as a privacy person, I'm like, how does she get all of my PII? She knew all of this information. But she did that. And I'll never forget the image of her running across the gymnasium saying, you got a scholarship and you're going to go to the University of Pittsburgh, and just her excitement. But I also do think, you know, we're all of the women in my family were, you know, my grandmother cleaned homes, and, you know, they just didn't have a formal education. And I saw the way that society treated them. And I said, you know, I'd like to have my own voice. And I can only do that by working on myself and learning and getting a solid education.
You know, I don't know why that just hit me really hard. But I think when I think back in my childhood too, you know, so my dad didn't have I think he went to freshman year of high school, maybe.
And look.
I know. But to your point, I saw, like, I'm going to get emotional, but I saw the way people treated him. Mm. And I as like a young kid would be so ferocious on his behalf, you know, like,
because you're like, that's not fair.
No. And so I never thought of that as a motivator. But hearing you say that, I'm like, wow, that was a motivator.
See, you guys are going to make me cry.
No, you're making me cry. I don't know if I've cried before on this podcast. Oh, my goodness. I mean, it goes without saying, thank you so much for sharing that very personal story. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate it. So tell us a little bit about, you have a sister, older, younger?
I have a younger sister. She's also a tax attorney. And,
wow.
She's very successful. And I have a younger brother. And so, you know, having, I think also maybe being the eldest of, you know, I said, hey, people would say you've got to be a good role model for your sister and brother. And I don't think I fully appreciated that until I got older. But there's something to be said about that. And so I always wanted to, you know, try to do my best and, you know, show them, hey, there's kind of a better way than these things that happen, in small towns, really all across America. And I think, you know, you look at certain things that, whether it's, you know, the fentanyl or the opioid epidemic, and you see how it has ravished towns, right? And it's not new, because before that there were other things that did that. But I think in particular it's very important to see representation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't know a whole lot of people that had went to college or graduated college. That was something that I said, hey, God gave me a brain. Let me try to work. And it wasn't, I don't think, anything that makes me special, but I really had wonderful mentors that believed in me, even when I didn't believe in myself. I think that the power of mentorship and sisterhood is something that's just fundamental.
We couldn't agree more.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any strong memories from law school? Like, I imagine that must have been really surreal for you. Like, you had wanted to do this thing for so long. People had told you you couldn't do it. Like, what was it like walking into your first law school class?
Katie, it was an out-of-body experience. And I think one of the things that I realized, I looked around my the class composition, and a lot of classmates, their dads or parents or, you know, someone had been in the legal profession or, you know, had done something or certainly had what I thought was wealth. I mean, anything, you know, I grew up on like food stamps and those sorts of things. So to me, everyone just seemed like they just had it together. But walking into that law school classroom, I think one of the core things that they teach you in law school is how would a reasonable man think about this particular issue? And I didn't feel like I fit into that mold. And this is, you know, back before, you know, diversity, inclusion, and all of those things were even words. And I was, I think, one of six African-Americans in the school. There weren't any African-American males. So I felt very alone and very out of place. I thought that, you know, okay, I was here. I think I have what it takes to get through. But as we talked about just a minute ago, some of that imposter syndrome. But, you know, I just remember feeling, how am I going to do this? In a sense of being out of my element. And I think it was when I started to read Lonnie Guinier and other folks who were in academia, who said, it's not natural to think about, you know, the reasonable sort of white man as issues, but you can bring in your whole self and your whole thinking to an issue. And those are things that not only make you a better lawyer, but a better advocate for people by having those different experiences.
Wow, that's really profound. I don't think I've ever even thought about the law that way.
Yeah.
Like, because basically, I mean, we talk about this all the time, like the legal profession is, or like just the legal system in general, is designed by a certain type of person for a certain type of person, right? Like any system, It's just how they came to be. It's there's no value judgment. It just is. And you're just basically saying, like, I wasn't that I wasn't who it was built by or for, right? Like, how did you see that manifest? Like, how did you find that you thought differently about those things?
Yeah, I think it, I think in criminal law and constitutional law, those are areas where it's the most prominent, because if you think about issues like slavery and, you know, what constitutes a person, and you realize that when the Constitution was drafted, you know, it didn't even consider, you know, African Americans in that drafting of it. And so how is it that, you know, the law or this framework that we have can protect you? And add on top of the fact that, you know, women didn't have the right to vote. And so you have this whole system that is built and designed, and in some ways is very much a relic of that today. And I think it's changing. But I think that when you think about how that system is not necessarily designed for you, ways, looking for ways in that system where you can try to create positive change so that the people coming after you can inherit a better system than you did.
I love that.
I know, me too. Me too. So tell us about your path from law school to the intelligence community.
That's one of the questions that I'm most excited to answer. I remember vividly, well, at the time I graduated law school, it was a bad time for lawyers, but I remember vividly on September 11th, 2001, I was in law school and someone said, hey, a plane hit the towers. And I thought it was similar to the first plane attack, where it was maybe not a plane attack, but an accident, because the World Trade Center had been attacked before. And I don't think anyone could have anticipated what happened. And I remember watching the towers fall down, and all of the kind of goals I think I had for myself at that time, I just had a sense of, I think, just number one, we were all Americans at that moment. Everyone was just wanting to know why it happened, how it happened, who did it. But it just affected me to say, you know what, I might have maybe wanted to take a career in the private sector or work in the government, but just this profound sense of wanting to serve my country. And I was fortunate enough to get a job as a presidential management fellow get a job at the Justice Department. and so I just remember getting sworn in and just saying, man, this is really cool that, you know, I came all the way from Washington County, Pennsylvania, to Washington, D.C., and, you know, my kind of ancestors would be proud. And so just that immense honor, I think, of public service that, you know, you just don't get elsewhere. And I think one of the things that it made me also realize is that now, going back to the comedic kind of course, you know, they're listening to everything, is that there's this balance of, you know, what can the government collect? What should the government collect? How do we prevent another September 11th, but at the same time remain true to the constitutional freedoms that make us great as a nation?
So let's pause here and kind of share with the audience the type of law that you do practice and what you do within, you know, the intelligence community, because I think that'll then we can kind of talk about that.
Yeah, so I right now I am an attorney in the Office of General Counsel, but in my former capacity, I most recently served as the Privacy and Civil Liberties Officer at CIA. And before that, I was the acting and the deputy director of the Office of Privacy and Civil Liberties at DOJ. And also worked as a federal prosecutor in Tucson, Arizona, as well as serving as a special assistant U.S. attorney in Alexandria, Virginia. So
primarily the last 20 years of my career. I've served working in law enforcement agencies, a bit in private sector and private industry, but also within the intelligence community. And as the privacy and civil liberties officer, I was responsible for advising the director of CIA, as well as other senior leaders, about the privacy and civil liberties issues that, you know, are attendant and kind of across the agency, and making sure that U.S. person rights are protected while making sure that CIA can conduct its foreign intelligence mission.
No. So much.
I know. I'm like ready to pounce. Where do we go? I think we're just excited because we really haven't. We've talked maybe a tad about this, a little bit, this is so important, and to have you on to kind of. To explain and for anyone who listens to this to understand what that means and how important your not only your job is, but why it's important for, you know, the organization and for our citizens.
Have you ever felt so? Privacy, civil liberties, and CIA, I think to many people, is like saying jumbo shrimp, right? It's like an oxymoron. Like, do you feel like, have you ever felt like you're fighting your organization, or do you feel like you're running in the same direction, or are there times where it feels like a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. I think one of the things CIA in particular, I think DOJ to some extent, you know, they're it's a law enforcement agency. It's an intelligence community entity. We're doing both of those things. But I think one of the things that, you know, is easy where, you know, you're not fighting against the system is that some of those things the intelligence community does anyway and does really well at protecting its sources and methods, protecting information, using it for the information for the purpose by which it was collected. And I think within the role of any privacy and civil liberties officer, it's one, being transparent to the public and talking and getting outside. And I think this is an excellent representation of that to say, no, there actually is an office that considers, you know, not legally necessarily, and in some cases, working very closely with the Office of General Counsel, you know, can we do this as a matter of law, but should we do this? And I think those are two fundamental questions.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think even just by having a seat at the table to say, okay, we are both trying to accomplish the same thing, but if we do X this way, it will minimize or mitigate some of those privacy and civil liberties risks. So I think, you know, it's definitely a very difficult job in terms of saying, no, we've got an office. And I think September 11th was one of those. And certainly there have been other things that have, you know, accelerated that discussion. But I think now, much like diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, people have to talk about U.S. persons issues because they're front of mind and really key to, you know, having those authorities because the government only has the power that the people give to it. So.
Yes.
And what would you say, like, most people, so not the organization itself, but the people who work at CIA, like, what is their, how do they see privacy and civil liberties?
Yeah, I think it's evolving. I think the scene, you know, the leadership, everyone gets it and understands it. But I think that there's, you know, a bit of awareness where, okay, what is the office? What do you all do? How do you, you know, speak to the public? As you said, an jumbo shrimp, right? how do you kind of talk to the public, but, you know, you're not revealing things. So there's this skepticism is probably too strong of a word, but there is, you know, what is it that you all do and how do you articulate your mission? And I think that it's a balancing act, internal to CIA, certainly at DOJ, to be able to demonstrate, no, we can actually help you do your job and we can actually be mission enabling and help you kind of get to where you need to be, but do so in a way that is defensible, not just to, you know, the agency itself, but to oversight, whether it's, you know, an inspector general, Congress, or the American people. Ultimately, you know, you have to be able to talk to folks to say, hey, here's what we did. Here are the facts. And maybe not all of the kind of sensitive facts. Certainly you can't do that. But explain the rule set by which the agency operates, which I think is just a critical piece of, you know, certainly now, again, certain things have, maybe I'm being too vague.
It's okay. I mean, people have to understand, the people that are listening that are from the intelligence community understand, and the people who are not have to understand there are limits to what you can say, and there are limits to our guests that come on. They have to, you know, they can say what they can say and they can't what they can't. Mm-hmm. But I think what was really important about what you just said is, I think, especially for people who are not in this community listening, that these agencies don't have, you know, this complete control. You know, they are held accountable to the American people, to Congress, to the president. They don't have this unwielding, like, authority.
Right.
And I think there's this perception that that's the case, right? And
yeah. And I think that that perception, one of the things Amy Zeigart wrote in her book, Spies, Lies, and Algorithm, which I think is a really good read, and it talks about this notion of spytainment. So it's much like what CSI did to prosecutors, where it's much more difficult to get in front of a jury, and the jury is, they're watching CSI or NCIS or any of those shows, and they think that everything is sort of pristine and has to be perfect in order to, you know, render certain verdicts. But I think, you know, the intelligence community has such a difficult job. Our adversaries only have to be right one time, and the intelligence community has to be right 100% of the time. And so I think that there is this perception that, you know, the U.S. intelligence community and apparatus has an unlimited budget, unlimited authorities, and where they don't have those authorities, they make them up. And that's just not the case, because there are offices and people that aren't in the public or, you know, in that space that are behind the scenes every day doing kind of the very difficult task of looking at, evaluating, and making sure that something is appropriate. And so I just want to highlight just all the good work that, you know, the folks do behind the scenes to think about, you know, those issues that you said, where that is just simply not the case.
Well, and to your point, you know, you were saying the intelligence community has to have it right 100% of the time. And what people don't realize is that those wins are not shared, right?
Not shared.
The only thing you hear in the news and in, you know, in public are when things go wrong, right? So all of the times that you have these big wins, you know,
you
can't celebrate them. And I think, to Amy Zeigart's point, one of the things why we're doing this and why we've produced a documentary about these women is
so excited for you guys,
is
by
like
the
anti-Hollywoodization of the IC, right?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, look, that's great for movies, right? James
and
Bond
TV.
And yep. Yeah, it's all fun. What's John? What is it? John? What's his name?
Reacher. Or no. John Wicker.
Well, whatever his
Krasinski?
Name. Yeah.
Okay, Katie knew.
Whatever his name is on the show.
Katie knew. She was, yeah, well, we knew.
Yes.
I might be a fan.
Yes. Maybe.
But, you know, they make it seem that it's like in the shadows and everyone's gun-toting, drinking martinis, and it's like sexified, yep, and all of that stuff. And so we hope when people hear this, they see what the real, you know, what they're real people.
They're real people.
Real people who, totally, live down the street, who went grew up in Pittsburgh,
right,
who grew up in Arizona, who were
Chicago,
your neighbors, yes, who are your neighbors, your friends, your aunts, and
their stories aren't told.
Right. And they're normal. They're normal people. They're not James Bond.
Well, it's so true though, because what you said when you were talking, like we were just talking about how sometimes there are things that you can share and there are things that you can't share, right?
Right.
Like if you and I were talking and you said you were telling a story and you're like, but I can't tell you this part. Like, I wouldn't think that you were keeping something from,
right,
me because you were trying to hide something or you were doing something to hurt me.
Right.
Because we,
right,
trust each other.
Right.
Right. So it's partly like you don't really need all the information when you trust the,
right,
institution.
Right.
And you trust the people.
Right.
That they have your best interest in mind. Right.
Yeah. And that's the key to trust is, you know, it can be given and taken away, and trust can erode over time. And I think that's why it's so important for folks in the intelligence community to get out and demystify, you know, some of those things that happen, to say, you know, we shouldn't be saying, just trust us, we've got this. We should be able to show our work,
mm-hmm,
and say, okay, you know, here are the legal things that we can do. We have important pieces to oversight where we have to explain them, which, by the way, is something that other democracies and, you know, kind of our friends across the pond, you know, rightly or wrongly, in some respects have really pointed, you know, a spotlight on privacy. And they talk about privacy a whole lot. But if you peel those layers back and you say, let's look at things, you know, apples to apples, oranges to oranges, you know, there you may say we've got one codification of, you know, let's say the AI law or GDPR, or we've got data protection officers in each member state. But do you really have the oversight that the United States government has, where folks have to actually go down to the Hill and explain, with a lot of, you know, precision and scrutiny what you did and why?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one key feature, I think, about the United States government that we don't do enough kind of sharing or walking through those distinctions between the European model of privacy and the United States, our sort of sectoral specific approach to privacy and civil liberties.
I would have never thought of that.
Yeah, I know. I think that's a great point, mm-hmm, for people to hear. So I don't know how deep we want to go down this road, but do we want to talk about how, you know, just demystify the thing about, like, why it's just logically, you know, just from the pain,
if you use your brain, right?
Why it is, there are many reasons why it's not true that the intelligence community is, quote unquote, spying on the American people.
Right.
But let's just take the case of, like, you know, our community, NSA is usually the one that gets picked on.
Yes,
is reading our emails and monitoring our phones. So I'll start. I mean, really.
I volunteer.
I'm going to start. But then we'll all jump in. Because,
okay.
I mean, just logistically. Let's just talk logistically. It would be absolutely impossible for the, you know, the people at NSA to read every email, even if they had all of them,
right,
to be able to read all of them,
to digest,
translate
all of the 350 million people.
How many texts do you think you send a day?
Oh my God, I can't even. I don't even want to think about it.
Megan can't even read her own text.
I can't even get through my own emails. No, that's a great point. Like, I have people saying, Megan, are you going to respond to me? And like, I can't even get through my own. So I just, that's, I'm going to start there. Like, it's just logistically impossible.
Yeah. And I think, you know, logistically, you know, just the amount of resources, volume, the traffic, I mean, it wouldn't be very effective, right? If you're kind of looking or looking at everything, right? You would want to be very specific. And I think one of the things that, you know, is important when talking about, okay, from a feasibility perspective, it just doesn't even make sense. And then from a cost perspective, it also doesn't make sense. But I think one of the things that it is worthwhile to talk about in this context is the Attorney General guidelines and the Fourth Amendment and the Privacy Act and all of these things that they have in place.
FISA,
which is an important tool with such, you know, just important efficacy and so vital for the U.S. intelligence community to be able to conduct its work. So even if you just assumed for a second, which is you know, not accurate, that you could do that, you have to ask yourself, why would you want to? And one of the things I think that is another important feature of the intelligence community is those functions are broken up by agency. So, you know, the NSA has the authority to collect signals intelligence. Mm-hmm. But in order to, you know, look at human intelligence, that's within the CIA's remit. And it's not a situation where all the power is sort of centralized in the Gestapo, which is something, you know, if you go back and look at history and sort of Nazi Germany and why some of those atrocities happened, those authorities are deliberately kind of divided such that not one agency, I guess it's a Kanye West song, has all that kind of power, right?
I had never thought about it that way. It's like checks and balances literally built into the system.
But exactly. Also, the mandate for these intelligence organizations are for foreign intelligence. It's not domestic intelligence.
I actually think this is an important point because one thing that you said earlier is you used the phrase U.S. person.
Yes.
And so I think it would actually be a really educational and helpful point. Like, what does that actually mean? And what are your constraints around U.S. persons?
Yeah. So it depends, as any kind of lawyer would say. But think about, you know, a U.S. person as someone within the United States. And so the CIA and NSA they're looking at foreign intelligence, as you said, information that is collected abroad about foreign nationals. I think part of the challenge in distinguishing that and sort of recently has colored that debate is looking at sort of incidental, you know, how is if someone is abroad and someone's a U.S. person and how do you tell based upon the location and other contextual information whether they're a U.S. citizen? And so I think that, you know, it's increasingly more difficult as our world becomes blurred and our sort of what is it a U.S. person is not necessarily just a black and white question, but the agency and the intelligence community, they are not, with the exception of FBI, looking at domestic information. They are concerned about the intent, the capabilities of foreign nationals and foreign powers.
Amen. That's all I have to say. Amen.
Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan, yeah.
The bottom hashtag, line. Hashtag Joe Rogan.
The bottom line is, if you think they're listening, they're really not. And if they are, they don't care.
They really don't give a shit, no.
But they're, you know, the thing is, I think it's so, it's just not a... It's just such a difficult question. And when people make statements like that, just carte blanche, where you're collecting everything, it modifies how people behave. And then you start to have kind of these Orwellian notions of how the world is. And it actually is just corrosive. And so I think that it's important when given an opportunity to really kind of say, no, we're not doing that. And in fact, you know, here are the limitations that are placed, you know, and the not limitation, but the guidelines for how we collect and how we maintain and how we disseminate that information. There's a whole rule set by which we do that. And it's not, you know, the Wild West. And, you know, we're not trying to take Megan's inbox and organize it by folder
and help her respond to all of her emails.
Because in some respects, you know, those are just things that, you know, aren't and shouldn't be happening.
I just want to say thank you for clarifying that. And it just to kind of full circle, because when we started this conversation about you talking about your grandmother and how you were very protective over her because, you know, the way she was treated. And I kind of feel like that's how we, Katie and I, feel about this community. We feel very protective over not just the women that we've had on, but just
and some exceptional men too.
Of course.
Yes.
That's right.
You know, it's just, you can, like, we're proud. We're proud to be a part of this. If you listen to any single woman who has been on, and men, because we've had men on the podcast. Mm-hmm. If you've listened to any episode, even through difficulty or they've had, you know, ups and downs in their career for whatever reason, all of them would say that they were proud to 100%. Work for this community.
Well, and not only that, but they hold democracy sacred.
Yeah.
Like it is literally a sacred thing. And civil liberties is so ingrained in that. And the reason why I asked about the humans is because my experience is you ask basically anybody that works in the intelligence community, like the humans actually doing the work, is this important?
That's right.
All of them will say yes. They will, it's not like an exception. Like they will absolutely say yes because it's just so core to what they're protecting.
That's right. And I think at least at CIA in particular, when you walk in, you can't help but be struck by the stars, the memorial stars of those individuals who lost their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are you have the sort of the sanctity of that moment of those individuals who literally gave their lives. And then you walk across the seal. You're given an oath. You have to swear to uphold the Constitution. And there is this profound, it's not driven, you know, when folks and having worked, you know, in private industry where everything is driven by profit or how much, you know, the bottom line is affected. The bottom line is the Constitution is as cliche as that sounds, and doing what's right at the end of the day.
Totally. So I would love to know, do you have any hobbies outside of work?
You know, my hobbies being, well, you're Midwestern and I don't know if you're, I love football. And so.
Did you watch yesterday was the Super Bowl for everyone listening. This is going to come out probably a month later, but yesterday was the Super Bowl.
Yesterday was the Super Bowl. I love football, and I think if
I... Are you a Steelers fan?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I have assumed a whole room dedicated. and I think in you know, if I'm being 100% honest, I think probably had I not gone to law school, and, you know, you just... Now you see women sort of on the sidelines and in the booth and on teams. I probably would have tried to have a career in the NFL.
Yeah. You could still be a lawyer.
You know, maybe if the NFL is listening, they need a privacy lawyer.
NFL, take Christy up.
Like,
she might be looking.
But I love the game of football because I think it brings people from different backgrounds, and they're, you know, it's a team sport. It's the ultimate team sport. And so there are people all working toward one common goal. And so my hobbies are watching football, being a mom to two teenagers, which is trying in and of itself.
If anyone can see my eyes, they're wide open.
It's so challenging. Being a mom, I think, is the hardest job. Mm-hmm. And I think no matter how, and this is across fields, like difficult work can be, and it can be very difficult and challenging. You know, when you go home and you see, you know, your kids run in and, you know, just being a mother, I think, is one of the most important things, you know, that you can do.
Yeah.
So that's my hobby is football, you know, being a mom and watching like Real Housewives of Potomac.
Oh, those you're a Potomac?
Oh, I was going to ask what city.
You know what?
Potomac.
I can't watch Potomac, and I'll tell you why. Because I feel like it's too close to home. It's too close. And so I feel like, I'm you know, Beverly Atlanta. Hills, Atlanta, Orange County, New York, even when New York went off the rails. And Miami, I went back and forth. But Potomac, I just felt like it was too close, and I don't know. It was like a weird like thing.
It is, but you should watch it.
Okay,
maybe I can convert you to.
Are you a Vanderpump person?
No, not as much. But okay. But any sort of, you know.
Are you a Bachelor person?
No. No. Although I did see that there's a Golden Bachelor.
Oh, that one was good. I was obsessed. It was the best Bachelor.
Was it?
It was, because it was not, I mean, there was, the cattiness was at a minimum. Like, it wasn't like the normal cattiness, because they were grown-ass women.
They're grown-ass
Yeah,
women.
They're grown-ass. And there was a fair, little.
They're all grown-ass
Well,
ass
that's
no,
true.
But see, grown-ass women, they don't have time for that.
No.
Right?
They
so
were
the older.
Yes, yeah. They were there for a reason. And they were all, after he picked his wife, who is now his wife, Gary, shout out Gary.
We're just shouting out everyone on this episode.
Why not?
Why not? Why not?
Why not? They all supported. Every single bachelorette went to their wedding.
See, that's
even
saying something.
Even the last woman left that he competed with.
Two.
Yeah, she even came. And aww, that says something.
That says something.
Yeah, it was really sweet.
See, so, I have to go back and watch
you have
this
to.
Now. And
do.
Katie, what's your show and your hobbies?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. It's so funny when I ask a question that I'm not ready to answer. great question. Like, what makes me interesting?
I'm gonna go back. I'm watching this.
Let's see. I am host podcasts, and no, I actually love to read. So our producer Amanda and I share a love for reading. So she's introduced me to my basically adult, like, fantasy romance era.
Okay.
Which,
okay,
that's all I will say.
I wish
about
everyone
that.
Could see Amanda's
if
face.
If you could see Amanda's face, she's like, oh my God.
Yeah, Amanda corrupted me, safe to say. That's all there is to it.
But, you know, when national security is such a heavy subject,
totally,
you've got to have those outlets.
Yeah,
I know.
You have to. Otherwise, it's just, it's so weighty and, mm-hmm, you know, you
I know.
Have those.
I do think I started to like fiction, actually, like around the time that I started working in national security, which now that I think about it.
That's not
maybe
a coincidence.
I should think about that.
Oh, my God.
What about you, Megan? What are your hobbies?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, I'm a mom.
Yes.
So that's a big portion. I love to read too, but it's difficult because I'm not the type of person that can just sit down and read. I have to be like in a zone. I have to have like the mental capacity and all of that. And then I just love creating things, like, you know, that's what we've done.
Totally.
Katie and I've done this a couple of times, where we just kind of sit in my backyard or at her house, and we call them dream sessions, and we say, like, what can we do? What is something fun that's not out there that we can do? And that's kind of my hobby.
Creating is really
creating.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
And anyone can do it.
anyone.
People don't think, they're like, oh no, I'm not, I couldn't, I don't have any ideas. We're like, yeah, you do.
You have ideas.
Just sit with us for
like 30 minutes.
Seconds.
We'll figure out your idea.
That's why I was, and I hate to sound like a broken record, I was drawn to what you all were doing. Because I think it's so important. And, you know, going and listening to, you know, Sue Gordon and, you know, Linnea Jones and Stephanie LaRue and just the excitement and authenticity, I think that they all brought. And, you know, just hearing Stephanie talk about how she came to the IC and just knowing the passion that she brings, I said, man, if I can even be, you know, amongst those women, like that is just something that is so exciting. And so you guys are giving such a voice to, and it could be a difficult and thankless job in the intelligence community, because there's a lot of criticism, but, you know, not a lot of, you know, opportunities to be creative. So I think what you are doing is so important. And if you think about all the women that, you know, are going to see the IC and have this as a resource, who it just didn't exist before, is just super cool.
Thank you. Well, that means a lot.
Yeah, it does. It does.
I can't wait to tag Joe Rogan and Sue Gordon in the same post.
And Gary.
And Gary.
Gary. I don't know if he has social media, but we will try. We're going to try him.
So I actually really love that you said that. And one of the things you said when you sat down, when we were talking about us meeting, was you said the butterfly effect.
Yes.
Right? And this is something we believe in so strongly, that like people can actually really make a difference. And there's just this interconnected web
100%.
That connects all of us, right? I guess I'm curious, like when you look back on your life, your career, like are there things that stick out to you of like ways that you feel like you really have seen that in your own life?
Yeah, I just have to, you know, there are maybe like three people like that just inspired me, four people. And, you know, at the agency, Bruce Burke is one. He was the Office of General Counsel's longest serving attorney. He's been at CIA for such a long time. And just the women at DOJ being in a room full of men and standing up and saying, no, we can do this. And it's such a male dominated world. And so in terms of the butterfly effect, I think as I get older and maybe need some of, like, I like that the lighting is good in here, and the microphones don't make, you know, me sound as old. But looking back at, I think the, hopefully in a good way, kind of some of the younger attorneys and people that I've tried to mentor and seeing them successful, it gives me so much joy and satisfaction to say, okay, if I could in some ways be a positive force for them, just the sort of the nature of that hopefully will impact people in the future. So.
I love that.
I love it too.
Yeah.
So we are at our last question. And so everyone always tells us this is the hardest one.
It is.
And so all of our listeners know that, you know, our podcast is named after Eloise Page. That was, and her code name was Iron Butterfly because she was a fierce fighter with a core of steel. So we would like to know, if you were to give yourself a code name, what would it be and why?
This is so hard. Oh my goodness. You know, I think it would be, there's two. And I don't know which, you guys tell me which one you like better. I think maybe Red October, only because I think, you know.
Ooh, that's such a good movie. That. Yeah, I like that.
I was like, that's a good one. And I like that. But I'm also a Prince fan. So I'm like, maybe Purple Rain. And that shows my age.
Oh, I love Prince.
You love Prince?
I love Prince. I'm just kidding. Have you ever watched New Girl?
Yes. Remember
when he was out?
And they started screaming. And they're like.
No, he goes, I didn't give you enough time to freak out. Like, and then they were like. Ah! We did. We had a lot of references today. Okay, so tell us why Red October and tell us why Purple Rain.
I think Red October, it's just one of the best movies. It's not necessarily, it's a spy movie, but it's a national security movie. But they're just, it's such great acting. And fall is my favorite season, and I like the color red. But I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s, coming of age. And I just, those kind of 80s icons like Whitney and Prince and those things. And you're like, they were watching the Super Bowl halftime and Usher. Hashtag.
And yes. Luda.
And, oh my gosh.
And Alicia Luda. Keys.
And Alicia Keys. Oh
my God. Could go down the list. Lil Wayne.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot.
We are going to get a great following after this.
But which one do you guys think is better if you had to pick?
What do you think, Amanda?
I'm going to look at Amanda.
She's covering
what first choice, what hits you first? I
like Red October. Okay. Red October. It is.
Yeah.
Maybe we could do a little reference in the somewhere to Purple Rain. Yeah. We'll do some reference.
Well, at Prince.
At Prince.
Well, he's since passed.
So he's in heaven. He's in heaven.
Oh my gosh. I don't think we've laughed this much ever.
I have the giggles.
For real. Yeah, we really definitely did. Christy, this was so fun.
Thank you.
I mean, really, thank you for just sharing yourself with us and our listeners. Thank you for bringing your expertise and sharing that as well. Thank you for serving.
Thank you.
And just saying yes to being here.
Well, thank you for having me. And I I know that the season is going to be the best season, and I'm thrilled to see the documentary and what you guys have for 2024.
Amazing. Well, thank you for being a part of it.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of Iron Butterfly Podcast. We want to thank the National Security Institute at George Mason Scalia Law School, our founding sponsor, and Amazing Women of the IC for their promotion. To learn more about Iron Butterfly Media, visit our website at www.ironbutterflymedia.com. You can also learn more about NSI and upcoming events at nationalsecurity.gmu.edu. And to find out more about AWIC, email amazingwomen.ic@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Lastly, we want to thank our podcast producer, Amanda Young, and the entire Iron Butterfly team. Stay fierce, and we'll talk next time.